The headlines this hour. Russia and Ukraine are set to hold a new round of talks as fighting rages on between the two sides in and around major Ukrainian cities. The European Union expands its sanctions against Russian banks as Moscow takes more measures to confront the bans. And Iran says its bitter experience with U.S. non-compliance and Europe's inaction has prompted Tehran to push for a reliable and sustainable agreement in the Vienna talks.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
It's the seventh day of Russia's military operation in Ukraine. Moscow now claims to have taken over Kherson, a southern Ukrainian port city on the Black Sea.
Russian armed forces have taken the city of Kherson under total control. Civilian infrastructure, critical infrastructure, and public transport work as usual. There is no shortage of groceries or staple goods.
Ukrainian officials deny Russia's claim and say fighting continues for Kherson. The Ukrainian army has also reported street battles in the country's second biggest city of Kharkiv, where Russian paratroopers have landed. Authorities say four people were killed in the shelling there this morning. The capital, Kiev, is also under attacks. On Tuesday, Ukraine reported the death of five people in an airstrike on a television tower in Kiev. Officials put the overall civilian deaths in Ukraine at over 2,000 so far. In fresh remarks, the Ukrainian president says almost 6,000 Russians have lost their lives, a claim that has not been verified.
Just think about this figure. Almost 6,000 Russians died. Russian servicemen within 6 days of war, a figure without enemy's losses during the past night. 6,000. To receive what? To receive Ukraine? It is impossible. It will not happen with rockets. It will not happen with bombs, tanks, any strikes.
Russia acknowledges that it has sustained losses, but so far has given no figures. The Russian Defense Ministry says its forces have destroyed over 1,500 Ukrainian military targets, including 60 planes. Ukraine denies suffering military losses on such a scale. Russia's defense minister has pledged to push ahead with the operation until all the objectives are achieved. Meanwhile, a second round of talks between Russia and Ukraine is scheduled on Wednesday. Previous talks failed to produce any breakthrough. Ukraine says Russia must stop bombing cities before meaningful talks on a ceasefire could start. Russia says that it sees no desire on the part of Ukraine to try to find a balanced solution. Meanwhile, Moscow is hit with more sanctions as the conflict between Russia and Ukraine continues unabated. The U.S. media have reported that Washington is preparing further curbs on Russian oligarchs, as well as their companies and family members. Meanwhile, the European Union has excluded seven Russian banks from the global SWIFT payment system. The bloc has also banned two major news networks, namely Russia Today and Sputnik. In recent days, Moscow has retaliated with sanctions and restrictions of its own. Moreover, experts say Russia will try to ease the pain of sanctions by taking extra measures, like relying on gold reserves and energy sales. Moscow has also warned that Germany's decision to freeze the Nord Stream 2 project could damage ties irrevocably and lead to a rapid and inevitable rise in gas prices. U.S. President Joe Biden has delivered his first State of the Union address to Congress. The conflict between Russia and Ukraine was the primary theme of his speech, during which he pledged that the West will be all united in the face of the Russian attack on Ukraine.
He thought he could divide us at home, in this chamber, in this nation. He thought he could divide us in Europe as well. But Putin was wrong. We are ready. We are united, and that's what we did. We stayed united.
And while you're at it, Biden had some tough words for President Vladimir Putin, accusing him of launching a premeditated and unprovoked war in Ukraine. He called Putin a dictator and said that he will pay a continuing high price over the long run. Biden said that Washington, with the help of his allies, is inflicting economic pain on Russia. And he even announced a ban on Russian flights.
We're joining with European allies to find and seize their yachts, their luxury apartments, their private jets. We're coming for your ill-begotten gains. And tonight, I'm announcing that we will join our allies in closing off American airspace to all Russian flights, further isolating Russia and adding additional squeeze on their economy.
Biden also said, and these are his own words, that Washington is choking off Russia's access to technology that will sap its economic strength and weaken its military for years to come. The U.S. president blamed his Russian counterpart for the anti-Moscow sanctions and claimed that Putin has never been so isolated. Biden said the conflict with Ukraine will leave Russia weaker and the rest of the world stronger. The Russia-Ukraine conflict is forcing tens of thousands of people to cross Ukrainian borders. According to UN estimates, roughly 830,000 Ukrainians have already fled to neighboring countries. Nearly 160,000 people are said to have crossed the border since Tuesday. The UN Refugee Agency warns that a surge in refugees could possibly reach 1 million within hours. Currently, refugees have been accepted into countries that have followed a hard stance on non-European migrants like Poland, Hungary, and Austria, among others. Meanwhile, the European Union has announced plans to give concessions to Ukrainian refugees. Some member states are even planning to grant Ukrainians protection, residency, and access to employment.
The first refugees fleeing from conflict-stricken Ukraine have arrived in northern Italy as Europe braces, the media are saying, for a major humanitarian crisis. So far, arriving refugees, who mostly comprise women, children and the elderly, have been registered in four Italian regions, namely Trentino, Veneto, Emilia-Romagna and Friuli-Venezia Giulia. In addition, scores of African-born expats have joined hundreds of thousands of people who are trying to escape Ukraine and cross into Poland and other neighboring countries. Reports have emerged suggesting that many black refugees have been subjected to racist and unfair treatment at the border with Poland.
Africans are being stopped from leaving Ukraine because of the color of their skin. It is shocking. It brings us back to the dark age of racism and intolerance against black people. I'm disgusted. Also because the media here in Italy do not cover these stories as they should.
Nigeria and South Africa have denounced such discrimination, calling on border officials in Ukraine and its neighbors to treat their nationals equally.
About 30,000 Africans, mostly from Nigeria, Morocco and Egypt, reside in Ukraine. They make up more than 20% of Ukraine's international students, attracted by the country's good technical and medical schools, combined with relatively low fees.
It is a basic principle in international refugee law, as well as in all human rights law, the principle of non-discrimination, a basic principle which has to be observed by all states, also here, certainly by Poland, Ukraine and the other countries around Ukraine.
The Italian government has recently agreed to redistribute Ukrainian refugees across the European Union. Italy will likely receive 13% of the total allocation. On Tuesday, Prime Minister Mario Draghi said, while reporting to the Senate on the Ukraine crisis, that, quote, Russia's invasion of Ukraine is a decisive turning point in European history. Max Civili, Rome.
Data shows that the Eurozone inflation soared to new record high last month, mainly due to surging energy prices on the continent. The EU's official statistics agency Eurostat announced 5.8% inflation in the euro area in February, up 0.7% from the previous month. The rise comes as oil and gas prices skyrocketed due to the Russia-Ukraine conflict. European natural gas prices have hit their historic peak, while oil surged to 7-year highs amid fears of supply disruptions. Brent crude topped $113 a barrel for the first time since 2014, and U.S. West Texas Intermediate crude followed suit hours later to hit the level of 2013. On Tuesday, the International Energy Agency, which includes the U.S., agreed to release 60 million barrels of crude reserves to try and curb soaring prices. But the disruption from Russia, one of the world's top oil and gas suppliers, could send prices even higher. Turkey has implemented an international pact on naval passage to the Black Sea under the 1936 Montreux Convention. Turkey has the right to close two of its straits to warships. This 1 week after Ukraine asked Ankara to activate the international pact and to prevent the transit of Russian warships from the Mediterranean to the Black Sea. Russian Sakalem has more from Istanbul.
Turkey has closed the passage of warships through its straits of Bosphorus and Dardanelles. The decision was taken after Ankara called Russia's military action in Ukraine a war. President Erdogan said Turkey is using the authority given to it by the 1963 Montreux Convention Pact on passage of its straits to prevent the escalation of the Russia and Ukraine conflict.
Turkey is determined to use the authority given by the Montreux Convention on Turkish Straits in a manner to prevent escalation of the Russia-Ukraine crisis.
Erdogan said he was very saddened by Moscow's attack on its neighbor, describing the move as unacceptable, adding that Turkey will not abandon its ties with both Ukraine and Russia. The Turkish defense minister, in his turn, asked all sides to respect the international pact Turkey has worked by, assuring that it is Ankara's right to limit passage in the straits in wartime. Kiev had already asked Turkey to close its straits to the Russian warships. The move will prevent more Russian ships from reaching the Black Sea, from where it had launched attacks on Ukrainian southern coast. Analysts say Turkey's decision does not only help Ukraine but also Russia, as the decision prevents all warships, not only Russian ones, from crossing the straits. Turkey maintains good ties with both Russia and Ukraine, as it bought S-400 missiles from the first and sold drones to the second, and does not seem willing to risk taking sides in this conflict. It seems that Turkey is trying to remain impartial in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, while it's trying to mediate to end the fight, with President Erdogan making some calls and pushing for a political solution. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has made his stance clear when it comes to Russia's military operation against Ukraine. He has said that the root causes of the problem lie in the wrong U.S. policies. But while many parties have voiced concerns about the ongoing crisis in Ukraine, it's frustrating to see the double standards in place when dealing with other crises in the world, like the war in Yemen or the Israeli violence towards Palestinians and the countless deaths that they have caused.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has blamed the American regime for the current Ukraine crisis. He demanded an end to the war in Ukraine, saying the Islamic Republic of Iran has always opposed war and destruction anywhere in the world. The U.S. disrupted the stability of the country by interfering in its affairs and organizing rallies and creating a color coup. We oppose the killing of people and the destruction of the infrastructure of nations. Leader called the U.S. a perfect example and manifestation of modern ignorance, saying it feeds off the crises it creates all around the world. Ayatollah Khamenei is referring to years of U.S. meddling in Ukraine since it became an independent state in 1990s. After the fall of the Soviet Union, the U.S. pledged not to expand NATO eastward close to the borders with Russia. But the U.S. and its Western allies reneged their pledges and started to include more Eastern European countries into the Western military alliance. In 2014, the U.S. implemented a color revolution in Ukraine and overthrew its democratically elected government. U.S. also supported the inclusion of right-wing groups and elements within Ukraine's government. It's now widely believed that in trying to move Ukraine into their orbit, Washington and its European allies overextended themselves. And Russia's intervention, firstly in facilitating Crimea's reunification with Moscow in 2014, then with the official recognition of the independence and sovereignty of the People's Republics of Donetsk and Luhansk, and now with a wider military operation to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine, is the result.
Iran's leader pointed out to a misconception among many countries who fall into the orbit of U.S. foreign policy. He has said the Western powers cannot be trusted since their promise of support will never materialize. He cited Afghanistan as one clear example. Also, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, another negative U.S. attribute is that it feeds off the conflicts and crises that it creates around the globe.
Elsewhere, in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said there are lessons to be drawn with regard to the Ukraine crisis. He said Western powers cannot be trusted and their support for their puppet regimes is only, quote, a mirage. Iran's leader said both Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and former Afghan President Ashraf Ghani have acknowledged that the U.S. simply abandoned them amid their domestic crises. As the crisis unfolded in Ukraine, the country's president, Zelensky, being left alone by the West. The U.S. has refused to send in soldiers to the country to protect its people and has only pledged more money and weapons. The same scenario happened in Afghanistan, when after 20 years of occupation, the U.S. disastrously pulled out of the country, leaving President Ghani and Afghan people alone in the face of Taliban fighters. The U.S. is facing backlash over its treatment of its Arab allies. Despite selling them weapons worth billions of dollars and pledging support, it has failed to provide them with sustainable security. It's now become apparent that the failure of successive U.S. presidents and their European allies since the end of the Soviet era has been to overestimate their own power and underestimate that of Russia, China, Iran, and other countries that are outside their sphere of influence.
Iran says the bitter experience that it has had with the U.S. non-compliance and Europe's inaction regarding the 2015 agreement has prompted it to push for a reliable and sustainable deal in the Vienna talks. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Adi Shamkhani, made those comments during a meeting with a number of lawmakers. Shamkhani said in addition to putting forth efforts to remove the sanctions, Iran is also focusing its strategy on neutralizing the effects of those sanctions. The lawmakers present at the session also called for the Iranian negotiating team to keep pushing so that a possible final agreement would compensate the Iranian people for the losses that they have incurred. The German chancellor says that an agreement on the revival of the 2015 Iran deal, known as the JCPOA, cannot be postponed any longer. Olaf Scholz made the comment in a meeting with the Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett in the city of Al-Quds. He added that a decision on reaching a good and reasonable accord must be taken. Iran has rejected any deadlines set by the West to restore the agreement. It has also reiterated that the JCPOA's revival hinges on political decisions by the U.S. and European signatories. Tehran wants the verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions and guarantees that Washington will not abandon the deal again as it did in 2018. The European Union is urging the Israeli regime to stop using violence against Palestinians as Tel Aviv's atrocities are taking place on a daily basis. The European bloc in a Twitter message has expressed concern about the daily attacks in the occupied West Bank. It says that Israel must stop the use of excessive force and live ammunition against Palestinian civilians. The violence against Palestinians is on the rise in the occupied territories. On Tuesday, regime forces killed three Palestinians in the West Bank. One of the victims was killed near the city of Bethlehem, while two others lost their lives in a raid by Israeli forces on the Jenin refugee camp. The Yemeni foreign minister denounces as shameful and ridiculous a UN Security Council resolution that extends an arms embargo on the Ansarullah movement. Hisham Sharaf says that the UAE proposed motion has turned the spotlight on the UN body's double standards. He added that the move shows that the Security Council serves the interests of Abu Dhabi and Riyadh that are committing acts of aggression against Yemen. The resolution was adopted on Monday. It came in the wake of retaliatory attacks by the Ansarullah movement against Saudi Arabia and the UAE. The Yemenis say that the reprisal attacks are aimed at pushing the Saudi-led coalition, which includes the UAE, to stop a war that began in 2015. The war in Yemen has claimed hundreds of thousands of lives, majority of them civilians. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. A new statistical report on the Zionist regime's most recent assault on Gaza shows the unbearable price paid by Palestinians for the maintenance of a Jewish state in Palestine. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Maureen Claire Murphy Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Gaza Pays the Price for Jewish State in Palestine. This is the first part of this article. A new statistical report on the Zionist regime's most recent assault on Gaza shows the unbearable price paid by Palestinians for the maintenance of a Jewish state in Palestine. Authored by three Palestinian human rights organizations, including Al-Mizan, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, and Al-Haq, the report examines the full-scale military offensive endured by Gazans for 11 days in May last year. The extensive damage that the Zionist regime wrought on Gaza further compounded the long-lasting humanitarian crisis in the Gaza Strip after 14 years of intensified closure and economic blockade, a form of collective punishment prohibited under international law. The Zionist regime, meanwhile, closed its crossings with Gaza during the May escalation. Two children referred for medical treatment outside the coastal enclave died waiting for access, according to the human rights groups. A rigorous field survey by those groups found that 240 Palestinians were killed by the Zionist regime's occupation forces during the 11-day offensive. Of them, 151 were civilians and 89 belonged to armed groups, though 10 of the latter were not actively participating in hostilities when they were killed. Among the 151 civilians killed, 59 were children, 54 were men, and 38 were women. The vast majority, 111 people, were killed by weapons fired from the Zionist regime fire jets. Nearly half of the total 240 people killed in Gaza during the war, and all but one of the women killed, were at home at the time of the Zionist regime's strike that ended their lives. One-third of the total 240 people killed were engaged in military action at the time. The human rights groups note the large number of casualties compared to the short duration of the military operation and the overall number of civilians, including children and women, killed. The use of overwhelming force against civilians is a key Israeli regime's military strategy. That strategy, the Zahiye Doctrine, is named for the Beirut suburb heavily bombarded by the Zionist regime in 2006, when it was roundly defeated by Hezbollah. By using indiscriminate and disproportionate force, the Zionist regime aims to restore deterrence and turn the targeted civilian population against the armed resistance, whether it be Hezbollah in Lebanon or Hamas in Gaza. In both places, the Zahiye Doctrine has failed to turn the people against the resistance, which has in both in Lebanon and Gaza increased its capacity and capabilities. During May last year, Palestinian unity across geographic and political divides galvanized in ways not seen in years and inspired renewed global solidarity. The May war began after the Zionist regime's police stormed Al-Aqsa Mosque while it was filled with worshippers, injuring hundreds. Tensions had been brewing in the city for weeks as the Zionist regime sought and continues to seek to expel Palestinian families from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood and hand them over to Jewish settlers. Resistance groups in Gaza fired volleys of rockets towards Al-Quds that night after a warning from the leader of Hamas armed wing over attacks in the city went unheeded by the Zionist regime. The Zionist regime began striking northern Gaza, where at least 20 Palestinians, including 9 children, were killed on that first day. The 11-day escalation ended with no decisive Israeli regime defeat against the resistance in Gaza, an automatic victory for the latter in the context of anti-colonial guerrilla warfare. The Zahia doctrine hasn't achieved what the Zionist regime intends, though it has inflicted profound harm on targeted civilians. But so long as Palestinians rightly refuse to submit to the removal and replacement with foreign settlers, the Zionist regime as the colonizing power requires a horrendously violent policy like the Zahia doctrine. That was admitted by the Haifa University demographer Aaron Sofer, a close advisor to the late Israeli regime Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, ahead of the latter's unilateral withdrawal of settlers from Gaza in 2005 and tightened blockade on the territory 2 years later. Sofer anticipated that Palestinians in Gaza, isolated and closed off, and with little other means of leveraging pressure on the Zionist regime, would rely on firing projectiles to resist what has become a medieval siege. "We will tell the Palestinians that if a single missile is fired over the fence, we will fire 10 in response, and women and children will be killed and houses will be destroyed," Sofer explained. Anticipating the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, Sofer added, "The pressure at the border will be awful. It's going to be a terrible war. So, if we want to remain alive, we will have to kill and kill and kill all day, every day." This violence is necessary to guarantee a Jewish Zionist regime with an overwhelming majority of Jews, as Sofer thought. That is the logic underlining the Zionist regime's violence last May, when War Minister Benny Gantz warned that no person, area, or neighborhood in Gaza is immune. And so, 14 families lost 3 or more members when the Zionist regime bombed their homes.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of RIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
May Allah accept all of the a'mal, all of the extra worships that dear brothers and sisters have been involved with in this blessed month of Rajab. It's worthy that on top of the rituals that we are to be involved with in the month of Rajab, which are of course themselves rituals with meanings that need to penetrate our minds and hearts. Repetition of adhkar is for the meanings to be repeated and for those meanings to be revisited, rethought, reflected, and through that process, that repeated process over time, the meanings gradually starting to seep or starting to come out of those words and seep into our minds, and then inshallah through action into our hearts. The oil seeds, it takes time for the process of extracting that valuable oil that can be taken from it. Anything valuable that is to come from a seed, more valuable than the oil that comes from it that we consume, and sometimes that process can be relatively fast, the process of the growth of a tree from that seed is much more time consuming, and that's much more valuable, because one seed can turn into a tree that produces many, many, many more seeds and fruits and valuables. The time that is required for us to process these adhkar, repeat, rethink, remind, over time, gradually it produces results. On top of these rituals that, as we just briefly explained, are also supposed to be helping us, there is a ritual of tafakkur, a ritual of thinking, a ritual that does not involve repetition of words or performance of actions in the various forms of the rituals that we have. Rather, it involves thinking regarding what's most important, thinking regarding what is important, that very topic itself, what is important and what is not. And for that ritual of tafakkur, what is required is material to think about. The best material a person can find to think about are the verses of the Holy Quran. This is not just reading the Quran to complete a recitation from the beginning to the end, which is referred to as khatm of the Quran, or completing a reading of the Quran. That is a ritual that is part of that repetition. We need to do that. We need to spend time just reading that. But then also during times of tafakkur, it is important to pull out verses, and instead of just reading and going to the next, just pondering and thinking on what is being said. Sometimes what seems to be very simple, a concept that we have perhaps heard many times, moments of thinking will cause us to realize how important that simple sentence is, and how much in need we are in processing that and being reminded of it and accepting it, and how much we need to realize that we haven't really accepted it. If you're looking for a truthful person, who do you look at? Where do you find this person? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا بِاللَّهِ وَرُسُلِهِ أُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الصَّدِّيقُونَ. They are the Siddiqun. Those who actually believe in God and His messengers, all of them, understanding that every one of those that God has sent as a guide for us is someone who has come with guidance from Allah, and whatever time I'm in, the guidance of the messenger that God has sent for that time is the one I need to go by. They are Siddiqun. They believe in the truth of God. They see that truth. So they're truthful in regards to the reality of the universe. They are truthful in regards to the reality of prophethood. They are truthful to that, not just in their mind saying that there is such a thing, or that there are prophets, or that the Quran is from God, but rather everything they do represents that truth and is based on that truth. And therefore, every aspect of their thought, of their beliefs, of their feelings, of their words, of their actions, every bit of it conforms with the truth of the world. Can there be a more truthful person than that? What's the comparison of a person who is truthful to this extent and a person who simply does not lie regarding a merchandise that they have bought and they're selling to a customer, if they're even truthful in that case? If a person is even truthful in all of the matters related to business. Because once you stop, once you commit the sin of lying to yourself regarding what the universe is, rejecting the truth that is blatant in your face, in everyone's face, that God exists, and that He didn't create this haphazardly. This is not abath in some useless, redundant cycle. There is a purpose for it. Then there are prophets and messengers. Who are they? What was the message? And I accept that and I act based on that. What's the comparison between these two different types of people who are truthful? Well, obviously, this is where a siddiq comes from. A siddiq is a person who is filled with truth, not just certain words regarding ordinary daily activities, but their thoughts are true, their beliefs are true, their feelings are true, their actions are true. Everything about them is...
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
in the limelight.
Recent scientific research has found that by 2050, the key drivers of major climate change will be feedback loops at both ends of the temperature spectrum. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Alfred W. McCoy, writer. This article is published under the heading, Melting of Ice Sheets is Dramatic, but Melting of Permafrost Means Mass Death. Stay tuned for more. When midnight strikes on New Year's Day of 2050, there will be little cause for celebration. But for most of humanity, it will just be another day of adversity bordering on misery, a desperate struggle to find food, water, shelter, and safety. In the previous decades, storm surges will have swept away coastal barriers erected at enormous cost, and rising seas will have flooded the downtowns of major cities that once housed more than 100 million people. Relentless waves will pound shorelines around the world, putting villages, towns, and cities at risk. As several hundred million climate change refugees in Africa, Latin America, and South Asia fill leaky boats or trash overland in a desperate search for food and shelter, affluent nations worldwide will be trying to shut their borders even tighter, pushing crowds back in tear gas and gunfire. Yet those reluctant host countries, including the United States, won't faintly be immune from the pain. Every summer, in fact, ever more powerful hurricanes propelled by climate change will pummel the East and U.S. Gulf Coast of this country, possibly even forcing the federal government to abandon Miami and New Orleans to the rising tides. Meanwhile, wildfires, already growing in size in 2021, will devastate vast stretches of the West, destroying thousands upon thousands of homes every summer and fall in an ever-expanding fire season. This dismal vision of life circa 2050 comes not from some flight of literary fantasy, but from published environmental science. Indeed, we can all see the troubling signs of global warming around us right now, worsening wildfires, ever more severe ocean storms, and increased coastal flooding. While the world is focused on the fiery spectacle of wildfires destroying swathes of Australia, Brazil, California, and Canada, a far more serious threat is developing, only half attended to. In the planet's remote polar regions, not only are the ice caps melting with frightening speed, already raising sea levels worldwide, but the vast Arctic permafrost is fast receding, releasing enormous stores of lethal greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. At that frozen frontier far beyond our ken or consciousness, ecological changes brewing largely invisibly deep beneath the Arctic tundra will accelerate global warming in the ways sure to inflict untold future misery on all of us. More than any of other place or problem, the thawing of Arctic frozen earth, which covers vast parts of the roof of the world, will shape humanity's fate for the rest of the century, destroying cities, devastating nations, and rupturing the current global order. In assessing the likely course of climate change by 2050, one question is paramount. How quickly will we feel its impact? For decades, scientists thought that climate change would arrive at what science writer Eugene Linden called stately pace. In 1975, the U.S. National Academies of Sciences still felt that it would take centuries for the climate to change in a meaningful way. As late as 1990, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, concluded that the Arctic permafrost, which stores both staggering amounts of carbon dioxide, CO2, and methane, an even more dangerous greenhouse gas, was not yet melting and that the Antarctic ice sheets remained stable. In 1993, however, scientists began studying ice cores extracted from Greenland's ice cap and found that there had been 25 rapid climate change events in the last glacial period thousands of years ago, showing that the climate could change massively within a decade or two. Driven by a growing scientific consensus about the dangers facing humanity, representatives of 196 states met in 2015 in Paris, where they agreed to commit themselves to a 45% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 and achieve net carbon neutrality by 2050 to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. This, they argued, would be sufficient to avoid the disastrous impacts sure to come at 2 degrees Celsius degrees or higher. However, the bright hopes of that Paris conference faded quickly. Within 3 years, the scientific community realized that the cascading effects of global warming reaching 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels would be evident not in the distant future of 2100, but perhaps by 2040, impacting most adults alive today. The medium-term effects of climate change will only be amplified by the uneven way the planet is warming, with a far heavier impact in the Arctic. According to a Washington Post analysis, by 2018, the world already had hot spots that had recorded an average rise of 2 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial norm. As the sun strikes tropical latitudes, huge columns of warm air rise and then are pushed toward the poles by greenhouse gases trapped in the atmosphere until they drop down to Earth at higher latitudes, creating spots with faster rising temperatures in the West Asia region, Western Europe, and above all, the Arctic. In a 2018 IPCC Doomsday report, its scientists warned that even at just 1.5 degrees Celsius, temperature increases would be unevenly distributed globally and could possibly reach a devastating 4.5 degrees Celsius in the Arctic high altitudes, with profound consequences for the entire planet. Recent scientific research has found that by 2050, the key drivers of major climate change will be feedback loops at both ends of the temperature spectrum. At the hotter end in Africa, Australia, and the Amazon, warmer temperatures will spark ever more devastating forest fires, reducing tree cover and releasing vast amounts of carbon into the atmosphere. This in turn, as is already happening, will fuel yet more fires and so create a monstrous self-reinforcing feedback loop that could decimate the great tropical rainforests of this planet. The even more serious and uncontrollable driver, however, will be in the planet's polar regions. There, an Arctic feedback loop is already gaining a self-sustaining momentum that could soon move beyond humanity's capacity to control it. By mid-century or before, as ice sheets continue to melt disastrously in Greenland and Antarctica, rising oceans will make extreme sea level events like once-in-a-century storm surges and flooding annual occurrences in many areas. If global warming grows beyond the maximum 2 degrees Celsius target set by the Paris Agreement, depending on what happens to Antarctica's ice sheets, ocean levels could increase by a staggering 43 inches as this century ends. We'll be right back. In fact, a worst-case scenario by the National Academics of Sciences projects a sea level rise of as much as 20 inches by 2050 and 78 inches in 2100, with a catastrophic loss of 690,000 square miles of land and expanse 4 times the size of California, displacing about 2.5% of the world's population and inundating major cities like New York. Adding to such concerns, a recent study in Nature predicted that by 2060, rain rather than snow could dominate parts of the Arctic, further accelerating ice loss and raising sea levels significantly. Moving that doomsday ever closer, recent satellite imagery reveals that the ice shelf holding back Antarctica's massive DeWayse Glacier could shatter within 3 to 5 years, quickly breaking that Florida-sized frozen mass into hundreds of icebergs and eventually resulting in several feet of sea level rise on its own.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat, or BAD 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
If Tabriz had not made that great move on February 18th, the tradition of holding 40-day commemorations and continuing the battle would not have started and become common for the Iranian nation. When the 40-day ceremony of the martyrs of Qom was commemorated in Tabriz on the initiative of the people there, it became a model. And various other cities in Yazd and Kerman and cities of Fars province and in various other areas, this movement started and it brought the people to the arena of revolutionary activities. And therefore, the presence of the people led to the victory of revolution. The victory of the revolution was due to the presence of the people in the arena and in the streets. This revolution was won neither by guns, nor by political games, nor by partisanship. It was won with the presence of the people. And the presence of the people was due to these movements, movements which started and were initiated in Tabriz. Therefore, all of us, including your dear people of Tabriz, should thank God that your move was blessed and led to the victory of the revolution.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Well, the February 18th Tabriz uprising is an event. Azerbaijan has gone through various events and throughout history from a few centuries ago onwards, as much as we can boldly say, from 3 or 4 centuries ago onwards, Azerbaijan has been a promoter of national unity and national resistance. In other words, Azerbaijan and Tabriz were a key point for the unity of the Iranian nation and an important center for training the Iranian people to withstand various incidents. This leads to great honors for this city and this province. Of course, the 29th of Bahman is a great honor for East Azerbaijan and Tabriz themselves. Another point which deserves mention is that one of the great advantages of Azerbaijan is that the flag of devotion to the Ahlul Bayt has always been in the hands of the Azerbaijan people.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.